Welcome, kind listeners far and wide. You're listening to Public Radio, WHRW 90.5 in Binghamton, New York. I'm your host, Tariq Abdelazim, and this is Civil Discourse. Criticism of this show is something I invite, so let me first offer my own. Last week, I was about as entertaining as a cup of condensed milk. But in defense, let me say this. The quiet before the storm, my friends. This week's show, Media and Virtuality, features an interview with Thomas DiZengatita, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and author of the upcoming book, Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. So cozy up to the dial, turn off the cell phone, pull the lint from your ears. Up ahead, an unsettling conversation of brilliant, bizarre ideas. But don't be quick to assume. This is not another media critic reiterating again how consolidated corporate media disinforms with crass sensationalism and makes America bone deep dumb. Of course, media does do that. But that's not the deeper thesis that underpins Tom's work. For Tom, it's not dumb, it's numb. And it's not just disinforms, but more profoundly, distracts. We are no longer talking only of information, folks, but total mediation. Before we connect with Tom, though, I want to first quickly scan the familiar terrain of media criticism. Do a Google for media critic and you'll likely find the works of McChesney, Gitlin, Chomsky, Bedikian, Alterman, Goodman, and others. You read the collection and you'll note the emergence of three familiar convincing arguments. 1. Information is not a commodity. News is no longer a public resource exchanged and distributed to inform and empower, but now a product marketed and sold to entertain and shock. Obviously, this then introduces another aspect, the consolidation of media ownership and its negative impact on democracy as a practice of informed citizenship. This first thesis is summarized neatly in Bagdikian's classic text, The New Media Monopoly, or the many works of McChesney like Corporate Media and the Threat to Democracy. And the threat is very real. Consider this, 6 principal owners. AOL Time Warner, Disney, Bertelsmann, Viacom, News Corp, and Vivendi Universal. Folks, we're talking TV, film, movies, publishing, periodicals, multimedia, radio, music, and internet. Almost every channel of communication controlled by 6 corporate gatekeepers. Number 2. The second tract of media criticism is to explore the idea of objectivity, or to wrestle with that assertion of a media bias. Alterman, for example, debunks the myth of a liberal media in his book, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias in the News. But as a friend succinctly wrote to me recently, the media is neither liberal nor conservative. It is corporate. 3. Finally, there is the critic who explores media's propaganda as disinformation campaigns. The obvious turn here is to Chomsky. A review of his book, Media Control, The Spectacular Achievements of Propaganda, reads as follows. Propaganda, says Noam Chomsky, is to a democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state. In other words, the means by which leaders keep the masses in line. In this slim pamphlet, he looks at America propaganda efforts and reveals how falsification of history, suppression of information, and the promotion of vapid empty concepts have become standard operating procedure for the leaders of the United States, both Democrats and Republicans, in their efforts to prevent citizens from raising awkward questions about U.S. policy. Now compare that quick summary of media criticism to 2 quotes taken from recent reviews of DiZengatita's new book, scheduled for release March 7th. In O Magazine, as in Oprah Magazine, we have the following. Reading Thomas DiZengatita's Mediated is like spending time with a wild, wired friend, the kind who keeps you up late and lures you outside your comfort zone with a speed rap full of brilliant notions. And then this, a clip from a review in Publishers Weekly, which couldn't be any more different. Quote, a must read for philosophers of every stripe. But rather than continue to talk of him, let's talk to him. It's my great pleasure to welcome to this show Tom DiZingatita, a thinker whose ideas link in a fascinating way the worlds of media culture and philosophy. And do we have Tom on the line? I hear dial tone. The wonderful introduction, bummed by the dial tone. Let's see, perhaps, see, we have a slight difficulty here because we are not allowed to make outgoing calls, so we rely on our guest to call in. And it looks like we have, all right, here we go. We have the call coming back in. I know he's a persistent fellow. Tom, do we have you out there?
Yeah, Tarek, here I am, guys.
Thanks, Tom, for joining us. Sorry about that minor technological snafu.
Not a problem.
All right. Again, I just want to come clean with the audience. I had the wonderful privilege to study under Tom at the Draper Program, the interdisciplinary graduate program at New York University. And I know firsthand that conversations with Tom are somewhat like roller coaster rides in the dark. So I don't know where the sharp bends and turns may come, when they come, but we're just going to launch into this.
Okay.
Tom, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm slightly nervous about this book coming out, I have to admit. It's a little bit like having a kid go into a big game or something, and you've got no control over what's going to happen. It's a weird feeling.
And this is coming out for March 7th release, correct?
The week of March 2nd, 7th, around in there, yep.
Okay, so I just read a couple of the reviews from both the Oprah Magazine and the Publishers Weekly, and they certainly don't sound like they are speaking to similar audiences.
That's
in the introduction here, I basically laid out the general media criticism.
Yeah.
Maybe you can help us. Well,
yeah.
You know, what differentiates this book from the many others?
Well, two things. The first is I basically agree with all of the critiques of the media that are in the sort of Alterman, Chomsky, I think Chomsky's a little bit of a paranoid sometimes, but I mean, in the left radical critique of corporate media, I agree with completely. Okay, so I just want to make that clear.
Okay.
I think I go beyond that in the following way, and here's a little anecdote to illustrate. Suppose you perhaps you as a kid, actually, I know you, Tarek, and when you're a kid, you get all involved in animals. I mean, you know, you're like 8 years old, and you're nuts about nature. Crazy, can cheetahs run faster than gazelles, and would a lion beat a tiger in a fight? And
were you talking to my mother?
Okay, well, then, you know, that kind of identification with animals that a kid has when he's growing up. And suppose that kid's asking you these questions, big wide-eyed, about the animal world, and you lean over and you say to him, look, kid, forget all that shit. It's about ingestion, locomotion, respiration, and excretion, and that's all that's really going on here.
Okay, let's keep the profanities out of
there. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I heard a promo there saying that language would be free or something. I misunderstood.
We have to be careful between 4 and 7.
Not another, I promise, nothing. But the point being that there's a lot more going on than just the fuel, the economic fuel and the power motives that drive these gigantic media machines. There's a whole lot of intricate, complex, subtle, psychocultural stuff that's going on in the inner phenomenology of the media that the standard critiques kind of overlook and miss because they don't take them seriously because they're interested ultimately only in the politics of the whole thing.
Okay.
So I focus much more on what actually goes on in people's minds and hearts as a result of living in a world that's, and this is point number two, factually saturated with mediation of one kind or another.
Right.
I mean, it makes up most of your life, and it constitutes a kind of world that people live in, and that means a certain kind of person emerges as a result. And I think those standard critiques overlook it. The second thing about the two quotes, if those two quotes kind of mark how this is going to go, then I couldn't be happier. I spent years trying to find a voice, a way to write, that would be accessible to an ordinary smart person who's interested in the world around them and wants to understand things better, let's say your average Oprah reader,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time to ring academic bells and to make allusions to academic themes having to do with postmodernism and deconstruction and all those sorts of things in the same book. So I don't know if I've succeeded, but insofar as the book's a work, a kind of a work of art, it's insofar as it succeeds, it's because I've managed to find a way to write that can do both of those things at the same time. That's what I'm. Wonderful. That's what I tried to do.
Well, this has definitely been shown in some of your pieces in Harper's. I believe you've had perhaps four pieces in the last 2.5 years. And the most recent piece was in the December issue, correct?
Yep.
That was wonderfully titled, Attack of the Super Zeros, Why Washington, Einstein, and Madonna Can't Compete with You.
Right.
Again, someone could read that and say, what the heck is this going to be about? But you seem to outline some of your main ideas, and I just want to return again to this word, mediated.
Yeah.
You know, could you kind of maybe unpack that a little for us? I mean, because it seems like you mentioned, I mean, Todd Gitlin came up with a book, right? Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives.
Right.
And it seems like you are kind of launching this idea further or approaching it differently. So
yeah, I thought I read that book and when I saw that sort of core idea of Todd's, I was excited. I was thrilled that someone had finally noticed the thing that's so noticeable about media that it doesn't get commented on that much, and namely that's just the sheer quantity, you know, and,
right.
and the inescapable characteristics it has. So that, you know, no matter how critical you are, you're resistant. You're still shaped by it. And while the specific way you're shaped, and I tell anecdotes, the book is mostly made up of examples and anecdotes. That's why it'll work for the general reader. And I tell numbers of anecdotes to draw our attention to essentially how hyper-self-conscious most of us are.
Right.
People talk a lot about irony and how that's an endemic aspect of our culture and nobody can say anything without putting quotes around it and all that stuff, and that's true. But I think that's a symptom of a deeper kind of reflexivity that's built into people who are essentially performing their lives in front of mirrors and models that they grow up surrounded by.
Right.
From the very earliest moments of their childhood, they're being encouraged to understand themselves by everything they're exposed to, Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, Electric Blue, Daw, whatever that one is. I can't keep track. I mean, it's my... And the extent to which the media focus your attention on yourself, okay,
mm-hmm.
is so, once again, so pervasive that it's kind of unnoticed.
Right. If I can read one of your anecdotes that just resonated with me from this last article.
Sure.
And perhaps that will help. You say we are so habituated to this flattery that it can be made remarkable only by contrast. And here's from the article. Say your car breaks down in the middle of nowhere, the middle of Saskatchewan, say. You have no radio, no cell phone, nothing to read, no gear to fiddle with. You just have to wait. Pretty soon you notice how everything around you just happens to be there. And it just happens to be there in this very precise but unfamiliar way. You are so not used to this. Every tuft of weed, the scattered pebbles, the lapsing fence, the cracks in the asphalt, the buzz of insects in the field, the flow of cloud against the sky, everything is very specifically exactly the way it is, and none of it is for you. Nothing here was designed to affect you. It isn't arranged so that you can experience, and you didn't plan to experience it. There's no screen, no display, no entrance, no brochure, nothing special to look at, no dramatic scenery or wildlife, no tour guide, no campsites, no benches, no paths, no viewing platforms with natural historical information posted under slanted plexiglass lectern things. Whatever is there is just there, and so are you. You begin to get a sense of what it would be like if you weren't the center of it all.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's a favorite passage of many people, by the way. And one of the reasons is, A, for almost everyone who's got any kind of sensitivity, they recognize that feeling immediately. When
right.
you're accidentally tossed into a certain kind of situation which wasn't prepared in any way to be viewed or used, That's the feeling you get. And I think it's extremely important to hold that up because it's so unusual.
Right.
And all of the other environments that you're in are, and then, of course, this has been true for decades, and even through the last couple of hundred years, it's been slow. The world has been slowly getting more and more kind of fabricated and representational. Of course, in the last 20, 30 years, there's been a quantum leap, which has made an enormous qualitative difference. And I mean,
right.
I don't have to. All of the obvious examples that people talk about all the time kind of fall into this larger theoretical category that paragraph illustrates.
Right. And so, I mean, suddenly, of course, we have to look, I mean, suspiciously then when we hear media critics and they say perhaps we have to, you know, create our own informational channels. We see the blogs. We see the memoirs. We see the chat rooms.
Yeah,
is that... Really?
Well, my man, I know. I'm here. You are launching your radio show. I know it's going to be great. I support it completely. I know you so well. But you have to cope with that irony. You have to deal with that irony.
Right.
I mean, it's there. You've added a voice, you know, to a cacophony of voices, all of which constitute a morass of options, which is so vast that it leads to a kind of inherent distance that people have with respect to the kind of mediated options as a whole. And then what most people do is they pick little niches that they identify with, and they sort of transform those little niches into little customized worlds. And of course the media is getting more and more adept at allowing people to do that. I mean, the most obvious case right now is iPod. I mean, you know, amazing thing. And then now they've even got iCasts. Have you heard about those?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, you've got some competition out there from people doing radio shows from their iPods.
Oh, okay, I thought that was a plaster cast on the iPod.
No. No, but anyway, the multiplication of communicational and representational venues to which all of us contribute, who do any of this kind of work, is part of the environment that leads to this kind of mediated person that the book is ultimately describing.
And then ultimately, I mean, there is no way to escape that. And that's part of the point, right?
This is a delicate matter, because the book itself as a work, and the Harper's essays, a lot of them as works, are designed to make people feel completely trapped. Okay? And I want to do that because I want to guard against what I think of as almost a little kind of psychopolitical pacifier reflex that the media is all too ready to a need that the media is all too ready to meet, and that is, you know, a need for solutions.
Right.
And solutions are for sale. There are solutions. Every book, every op-ed piece, every time I go on a radio show, and I've been on a lot of them, I get to a point in the interview, and the guy kind of heaves back. Let's just assume that he or she has kind of understood what I'm saying. And they heave back, and they go, and I've got like 2 minutes left, right?
Yeah,
towards the
minutes.
End of the show. No, I'm not. I'm talking in general about
on
the radio. 2 minutes left, the end of the show, the host says, okay, so I see what you mean, but what are we going to do about it? So
yeah, that's my question number 7.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, and I really actually do have some ideas, but they're extremely complicated, and they involve ongoing work I'm doing right now, and they involve an analysis of human nature and history and the human condition and what consciousness is, and a rethinking of the nature of power and property. And in other words, you know, serious intellectual theoretical work.
Something you won't find in a 700-word column,
I'm afraid. I just can't. So the book, the first book, the one that's coming out, and the essays, are really diagnostic and not prescriptive.
Right.
And the more they draw people's attention to the fact that we're kind of trapped in this feedback loop of representation that we can't get out of, the better. Because if there is going to be any satisfying, and I know this is your main concern, and it's ultimately mine as well, if there's really going to be any satisfying political movement that we can make into the future, reorganize some kind of progressive politics that makes sense for the world that's upon us now, it's going to come from a diagnosis of our condition that's going to be comparable in depth to, and just to keep it apolitical, comparable in depth to what John Locke and Adam Smith did for early modern times, or Marx did for the Industrial Revolution. It's got to be, we're in a whole new world, right. A mediated world, literally. And so far, I mean, I like to think of this book as the beginning of a contribution to a serious analysis of its characteristics. And there, I don't mean to say that I'm the only one. There are many, and I right. credit them in the book. But we've only just begun to understand the situation we're in. And unfortunately, one of the characteristics of the situation we're in is that it changes so goddamn fast. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It changes so fast. The diagnosis, the concepts you're going to have to bring to your diagnosis are going to have to be pretty deep, or they're right. not going to apply anymore.
Right.
And that's why, I'm sorry, but that's why this thing about the flattery of representation, that's why I foreground that in the book, because I think that's going to be a constant.
Right.
And also the way options work to distance us from reality, I think that's going to be a constant, no matter what comes next.
Right.
And when I say flattery of representation, I mean literally almost the way an evolutionary psychologist might think of it. The more a person is addressed, the more things are aimed at you to affect you, the more they solicit you, the more flattered you feel. And I think this is almost hardwired.
Right.
So then there's this accident of putting a person who's hardwired to react to being addressed into environments like the ones we live in now, which are soliciting us and flattering us and making us central in all, you know, that's the virtual revolution idea emerges from that, you know.
Right.
There's a profound sense in which every mediated person feels entitled to be at the center of the universe.
Sure.
Because in fact they are at the center of a mediated universe.
Right, right. It's not necessarily just desire alone. It's possible. It's there.
Yeah, you actually are. I mean, think of what you can do. Anybody.
Right.
You're like a god.
www.sarahoconnor.com. There okay. you are.
Yeah, okay.
Your world.
Yes, exactly. I mean, just anything. There's a whole chapter in there about nature, which is some ways is my favorite channel. I talk about these amazing museums and exhibits, and you can watch the Big Bang. You can travel in 20 minutes with Tom Hanks on an intergalactic thing and see like what it looks like when stars are born. Or you can go downstairs to another part of the museum and you can enter a chromosome and you can flow up somebody's blood vessels and you can turn the channel, flip a switch, and you're at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean looking at life forms that have some genetic code that's different from all of ours. And you can switch another channel, and you can see a supernova. Then you can go over to the porn channels, and you can see anything.
Right, the virtual online community.
Everything.
You could even recreate yourself exactly as you desire.
Anything you want, it's representationally speaking, is there for you. Anytime you want it. And if that's not flattery, and if that's not having huge psychocultural effects on people, then my book's wrong.
Well, Tom,
I think it is.
I just want to say, I mean, you've just given me about a 23-second intellectual orgy, so thank you. And this will resonate for some time. And there are many people out there that, of course, appreciate your work and are very much looking forward to the book.
Great.
And your continued work.
Great.
Thanks again, Tom, for being
with us. Okay, Tara, good luck with your show, man.
Thank you, man.
Take care.
I just wanted to inform all the listeners out there. It was fascinating, fascinating ideas. His most recent article, Tom DeZengatita's, is Attack of the Super Zeros, Why Washington, Einstein, and Madonna Can't Compete with You. But even more importantly, his book, Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It, is scheduled for release around March 2nd. There will be information about topics that were addressed on this show at my website, www.modocpress.com, modocpress.com, and I will have a link to Tom's work as well. So please feel free to inspect and probe into these ideas a little deeper. I hope you enjoyed this week's show. Next week, we have another interesting show planned. It's called Frivolous Justice. There will be an analysis of the campaign behind tort reform and the many different litigations that are legislations that are on Congress. Commentary on the frivolous lawsuits you won't ever hear reported on the evening news. The fact that most of the frivolous lawsuits you hear are fictional. And we will be featuring another exciting interview with guest Jeff Bohm, the legal director at the Center for Justice and Democracy. Again, thank you for tuning in. This is WHRW 90.5 Binghamton. I'm your host, Tariq Abdelazim. This is Civil Discourse, and I hope to see you again here next week.
WHRW presents.
What's that?
It's WHRW's new lives department. They book bands every other week.
How can I find out more?
Go to their website. It's www.whrw-presents.webhop.org. If you're a band, email us, them, your info at whrwpresents@yahoo.com.
What's their slogan?
It's WHRW presents the best underground live music on campus.
Oh, no.
I really like this
1 minute,
stuff. 10 seconds.
Oh, Dale, you're not supposed to say that!
It's written right there!
Obscenity is a legal term. It has nothing to do with the real world. As the legal profession doesn't have anything to do with the real world either.
This program may contain frank language or subject matter. We therefore advise you to use your discretion as to whether you or your children should listen. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the staff or management of WHRW Binghamton.
There is no word that you can say, nor is there any noise that will come out of your mouth that is so